Welcome to the Working Dog Depot podcast with your hosts, Rich Harden and Howard Young.
Howard Young, how are you, sir?
I'm great. How are you?
Doing fantastic. Settling down from a long weekend of hard work, but life is good.
Yeah, I think I didn't work too terribly hard. I kind of had a bunch of yard work I tried to get done today before the rain came, and it came in abundance, like almost an inch and a half in a few hours or an hour. It was crazy, but we need it. I'm not going to complain about the rain at this time of the year.
Well, what's going on in the dog world with you?
Well, Hits is coming up, and that's we got about a week before that takes place. I've been checking out the temperature in Scottsdale, Arizona. That is unbelievable.
It's going to be
well over 100, well over 100 degrees every day. Well,
I'm sorry I'm going to have to miss this year. I was really looking on. I wanted to go this year.
Yeah, it would be fun.
Maybe next year.
Yep. All right. So tonight we have a guest that that I respect tremendously, and he's very well known for his tracking and kind of a guru of tracking, if you will. His name is Jeff Shetler. Welcome, Jeff.
Thanks. I really appreciate you guys having me on tonight. Looking forward to the conversation.
Welcome. Welcome.
Thank you.
Well, so go ahead. I always like my first question is, what got you in the dog world, man?
Well, you know, it's a long story. It's actually the pet industry. My first job as a kid when I was 12 years old was working for a pet store. And, you know, my niche actually really at that time was tropical fish and birds more than anything else. Birds became a big thing. And in the 70s, my specialty was training wild caught parrots from, you know, South America, from Africa, and then, of course, also from Australia before all that stuff got shut down. The dogs came not much longer after that. And so I would say, you know, right around 15 years old, I really got into dog stuff, and, you know, not police work or patrol, but just, you know, general pet type things. And really early involved in a lot of the early nutrition stuff that started coming up with dogs as well. When that first began, I was about, you know, 17 or 18 when dog food trends began to change just a little bit. The actual police work when I started working with dogs, it wasn't until 1994. But prior to that, I had been working with wolves. I actually had a couple and used them for a lot of different purposes. And a lot of the philosophies I have of how dogs work are based on my experiences with the wolves and how they worked and how they did things just naturally. And I just kind of applied it to the police work stuff later on.
Very cool.
But mm-hmm. You got your start. You started out in California, didn't you?
I did. I was with the city of Alameda, which is a small town sandwiched between the city of Oakland and San Francisco. And at the time, it was really a gorgeous little city. And it was a kind of a jewel with nothing but, you know, crime and everything surrounding it in the San Francisco area. And of course, Oakland and everything else. It's changed quite a bit since then. But that was where everything started. That's where I had my first dog.
Mm. And did you start off with a shepherd?
I did not. I actually started out with a bloodhound. I had been interested in, you know, the tracking aspect of things, and I had a genuine interest in catching people. And at the time, a lot of the reading I was doing, and you have to understand, at that time, we really didn't have the internet going like we do today. So you couldn't Google search tracking and trailing and come up with this plethora of wonderful information that we can now. So back then, you actually had to make phone calls and meet people in person. And I know that's difficult for people nowadays, but, you know, then that was really the only way. You had to get good face-to-face contact, go out there and meet people. And when I started, I actually spent a lot of time driving all over the country just to meet with different dog guys, learn their philosophies and how they trained, and try to apply whatever they did to my program, that is, if it worked. And at the time in Alameda, my dog was the first, and I didn't realize it. I had no concept of it. But at the time, my bloodhound was the first full-time police bloodhound on the street in the state. There was some in search and rescue, not a lot, but there were a few. But there weren't really any full-time law enforcement hounds. It was a brand new thing. And since that time, you know, going back to 94. Now there's a lot, many, throughout Southern California, Northern California, all the big cities, they're all working the hound. So that was my beginning. And I was taught, and this is I think still kind of a thing today, is that, the bloodhound was the be all end all of fracking. That was what I was told. That was what I was taught. And, I was basically informed that, no other dog could hold a candle to a bloodhound in tracking and trailing. And so when I started, I had no other choice but to really believe that, because that's what all my peers and my trainers were telling me. But as time went on, and as more importantly, I started applying a lot of what I did with my hound, and we started applying it to patrol dogs, I quickly found that there really wasn't a big difference in dogs other than appearance and drive, and whether they wanted to do the job or not. And in many cases, the shepherds or the mals or the crosses that we had at the time worked just as good as the hounds did. And it was a big eye opener for me. And it was actually kind of great, because it opened up a whole new world of training. And that's when we started working with a lot of the patrol dogs, doing the bloodhound style of tracking and trailing work.
Very cool. So, Jeff, what year is that? I'm sorry.
Well, that was 94 was when I got started. And I'd say 97, 96 was when I started first working with the patrol dogs with tracking. Before that, I worked with the guys all the time, because we did stuff in tandem. And of course, we trained together, but we didn't actively train in my tracking style with those guys. And actually, the first handlers that I worked with were Oakland PD. They came and started integrating some of my style into their program. And it was actually quite a great collaboration. And I really, really thoroughly enjoyed it. And it carries on to this day, because I would say 80% of our dogs are patrol dogs that come through the program. Right. So, yeah.
Is there anyone that you feel like that was particularly instrumental in helping you get started?
Yeah, there was actually several. There was a guy named Jerry Nichols out of Colorado, bloodhound handler. Another guy out of Colorado named John Lutenberg. And then probably one of my best was a guy named Glenn Rimby. He's one of the old school hound guys from way back. He's dead now, unfortunately. He died about 10 years ago. These guys really set me on the path that I'm on today. And, I do things dramatically different than all three of them today. I mean, I wouldn't say really there's any similarity at all, but they were my foundation. And for good, bad, or ugly, if it wasn't for them, I wouldn't be here today. So, I'm thankful to their time and their efforts on my behalf. I mean, they really made a difference in me and what I'm doing.
That's awesome. One of the things that was mentioned in our last, and I don't know that they were mentors necessarily, but can you differentiate for us what the difference in trailing versus tracking is?
It's a great question. And actually, I kind of go back and forth. I mean, if you ever watch when I'm writing on social media or anything that I publish, you see that I use the terms, back and forth together, right, meaning almost the same thing.
Right.
Yeah. And it's really because, neither term is actually accurate. And so really what I use today, what I like to use the most, is the term manhunting. And the reason why I like that is because you're not focusing on a particular methodology with the term. You know what I mean? It's hunting a man. And what that means is you're using the dog's instincts and capabilities to the utmost to get the job done in finding people. And I don't care if that's ESP, if the dog shows that they have ESP to find a guy, but by all means, we're going to use ESP. But I think sometimes we have this tendency, especially in law enforcement, to, micromanage terminology. And we confine ourselves sometimes to training methods because, we can't really look outside of our boxes. And I think sometimes that terminology keeps us there. But to answer the question, tracking and trailing, historically speaking, is following the footsteps of one person from one point to the other. And historically speaking, that's going to be based on Schutzen style training, later IPO, things of that nature. And in doing that, of course, the dog is directed to stay right in the path of those tracks, and they're compelled to do so through lead pressure, and then also, of course, other types of things, such as hot dogs or whatever you can do to keep that dog in that place. Whereas trailing, on the other hand, is the belief that the scent picture the dog is following is blown odor coming off the human body in the form of skin rafts and skin cells, and then also off-gassing. And, you know, that also has its way of working. In other words, when the scent picture falls off the human body, it moves into different places and collects, you know, wherever it might. And the dog has the ability to move to those places to collect that odor or to use that odor. And the way I believe it works is it's a combination of several factors. When the dogs are actually following odor, it's multifaceted. It's ground disturbance if it's available, right? Contact odor if that's available. Skin rafts if those are available. And then also the off-gassing. And I think they do it back and forth very quickly. So fast, sometimes the average human can't really process it. You know, if you ever watch wild canids hunt, you know, for example, they never stay in the track, really ever. You know, they move in and out of it based on the terrain features that they're in and the scent picture that they're in. And I think a lot of times we have really reduced our dog's ability sometimes because we confine ourselves to a way of thinking and how scent works and how the dog has to work that scent. And our system and our philosophy is a little bit more based on, number one, understanding what the dog is looking like when it works, right? What is the dog's unique behavior in odor? And then following accordingly when it is an odor, and then, of course, not following when it's not an odor. But that's the key part. And in order to do that, you have to kind of change your way of thinking, because the classical form of thinking for tracking is nose down, tail up, consistent direction of travel, consistent pull. But the reality of it is that dogs can track with their nose head high. You know, it just depends on the conditions they're in. They do not have to have their nose to the ground. And there's a lot of breeds in particular that just really don't want to do that. You know, they have a tendency not to put their nose on the ground. So the biggest difference, as I can see, is, you know, tracking is compulsion to stay in one particular location, whereas trailing is allowing the dog to follow odor wherever it might be. They both have their limitations. And so my philosophy is a combination of the two. I believe that you need to use all the resources that are out there, all the dog's capabilities, and allow them to, you know, hunt the way they want to hunt. So it takes a little bit a different approach, and sometimes it can be a little frustrating because I think for the average person, you really don't see what the dog is doing for a while. It takes some time. For example, when we start our dogs, we start all our dogs off lead and tracking, no equipment, no nothing. Yeah. And we'll put the track out and the trail layer out there, and we allow the dog to do it however they want to do it. And in the initial stages, it can look really chaotic. It looks like the dog's all over the place, and certainly they are.
Do you pay particular attention to the wind when you start?
Yeah, it's a great idea to have it so the wind's not in the dog's favor, you know, so right. They have to use that ground odor or that contact odor if at all possible. But, you know, there's sometimes that you can't control that. You know, as you know, you'll get out there and you start with it at your back, and 2 seconds later it's in your face and the dog air scents all the way in. But our system is based on, you know, self-discovery and self-correction. So we put the dog out there, we give them the motivation to find the source, whatever it might be, and we want them to make the mistakes. We want them to come off track. We want them to, you know, do these things and then self-correct. Because ultimately speaking, we want a dog that's an independent decision maker out on the track versus a dog that's really susceptible to lead pressure and lead control from the handler. And I think by working off lead in the beginning with a lot of self-correction and self-discovery, our dogs have a tendency to be a little bit more independent on the track in the long run. So we start with most dogs when they're 8 weeks of age, but we do also train a lot of adults too. But we start at 8 weeks of age and we train them usually for about a year. And from the puppy stage at 8 weeks, they're usually off lead, no equipment until they're about 16 weeks old. And then at 16 weeks, we add the harness, and then we add a short lead just dragging behind them. And then we add a 15-foot lead dragging behind them. And then finally a 30-foot that you start picking up on. But the whole idea is I want a dog that when it comes time to us to actually pick up that lead, that, you know, it's a fur missile on the track. There's nothing you can do to stop it. It doesn't care what you do with the lead. Doesn't care if you get stuck. You know, they're hell bent for leather to find source. And so generally, if our puppies are, if they can do 650 meters long, about 20 minutes old, that's when we start putting the equipment on. And if they can find their man over and over and over again reliably. And we, of course, we only do it on soft surface to begin with. The urban environment doesn't come until a little bit later.
Mm-hmm. Very good. What I really liked you said about the dog not being susceptible to leash pressure. I thought about how that really plays into detection as well. That you mm-hmm. want that independent dog that is going to go out there regardless of what the environment holds or what dummy is at the other end of that leash. You want that dog to go to source. That's really good.
Yeah, I agree. We do our detection work the same way. We start everything off lead.
Right.
You know, I prefer that independent dog making decisions on his own, and they seem to like it better a little bit, I think. You know, that's just my general opinion.
Yeah.
What are you using for your puppies as a reward for finding a guy in the beginning?
It depends. Every dog is a little different. So we run the gambit. You know, I believe in, you know, you got to do what floats the dog's boat. And so sometimes it's tuna fish, sometimes it's Vienna sausages, sometimes it's a ball, sometimes it's a Kong, sometimes it's a tug. And sometimes, you know, we actually have, and these are the trackers I actually find to be the best. And it seems to be a common denominator. They don't want anything. They just want to start the track again. Mm. You know, in other words, they find the person, they're happy, but they don't want a food. They don't want a toy. They don't even want to be pet. You can just see them looking for another track. These are the really amazing dogs. The reward has nothing to do with it. The track is actually the reward. It's kind of a rare one, but it actually goes to the importance of creating a high value track. You know, a lot of times we have this tendency as trainers to think that the toy and the reward are the be all end all, and not understanding that it's the game and the pleasure of the game that is part of the reward package. And I think we sometimes really miss that. We concentrate on, you know, oh, we got to have that ball, or we got to have that Kong, or we have to have this cookie cutter method, not understanding that it's the actual act of the hunt, the thrill of the hunt, that's half the reward.
Very nice.
I would say it took me a long time to figure that out.
Mm-hmm. Oh, me too.
I've seen it with detection dogs as well, and it is rather rare, mm-hmm. but it is really cool to see the dog that you mark the behavior, you give him the reward, and he's ready to spit it out and go right back to work. He just loves the hunt.
I see a lot of it in the bloodhounds. It's more common in the hounds than just about anything else. Well, not just the bloodhounds, but plot hounds, walkers, blue ticks, you know, red bones. I see that behavior more in them. And I think a big part of it is that, you know, you've got hundreds of years of breeding for the job, and it's the only thing they do. There's nothing else but, you know, tracking, trailing game. And so it's in their blood. That's the only thing they want to do. I think that's probably the reason, you know, but I'm not exactly 100% sure.
What is your breed of choice for tracking?
You know, it could be a dirty mouth, you know, bald chihuahua, as long as he tracks well. You know, I don't care. You know, I just love a good tracker. You know, right. The breed is not it for me. A lot of people think the bloodhounds are my breed. And I mean, from a business standpoint, it's a big part of our business, the hounds. But what I want is I want that dog that is incredibly reliable, that the only thing they want to do is find their man and do it well over and over and over again. So sometimes it's a German Shepherd, sometimes it's a Mal, you know, sometimes it's a hound dog. But, you know, it's amazing because it changes all the time. I have a new favorite dog every year. Pretty much, just based on what's coming across our table.
That's very nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I was up in Connecticut back in June, and there were some Massachusetts mm-hmm. State Police guys there. And they have learned a tremendous amount from you. And I got an opportunity to watch them do a little tracking, and they were impressive. They were really getting after it.
They catch a lot of bodies.
Yeah. Yep.
Yeah. We started working with them, I want to say about 6 to 8 years ago, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm. We've done a few classes up there. It started with one of their students or one of their handlers, a good friend of mine, George Demos. He's now a captain and works in the academy. But he had a Dutch Shepherd that did not work with the traditional tracking well at all. As a matter of fact, he was George was basically told this dog can't do it. It's not going to work. And so he sought me out to come down and see if maybe something a different style of training might work. And so we used the style that we're talking about with his dog Cayman, and Cayman just blossomed. It's what he needed, and it worked out really well. And as soon as he went back home, he started catching guys left and right. And I think that's really what got the attention of some of the other handlers is his find ratios. They went really, really up quite a bit.
Success has that effect sometimes, doesn't it? People see other being successful and they want that as well. That's good stuff right there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it truly is. And George is an amazing guy. Good dog trainer, good handler. Cayman just recently died and he was an amazing tracker. Lots and lots of good finds. I shared a lot on my Facebook page all the time when he was on duty doing his business. Great dog.
So one of the things that I appreciate about your illustrations that you post, mm-hmm. where you have the track layer in one color and the actually mm-hmm. dog tracking in the other color, is that it really shows, it tells the story. You know, it tells the story in a way that handlers don't expect the story to be told, if that makes any sense. Mm-hmm. I think there is an expectation mm-hmm. when we lay a track, in spite of our teaching and as it relates to wind and all the conditions and things that change, mm-hmm. is that I think there is an expectation for most handlers that a dog assumes that traditional tracking posture and they just go exactly where the mm-hmm. person went. And what I see time and time again, and I've pointed this out to you on your through messages, is that this shows that dogs get off the track. The traditional mm-hmm. footstep track, mm-hmm. and they are mm-hmm. able to reacquire it. And sometimes, based on the conditions, they may skip a whole huge mm-hmm. section. And mm-hmm. I just really think, and I use those illustrations to share to with some of my guys to just say, "Look, this is a, mm-hmm. this is a successful track. That's not mm-hmm. what you have in your head." So, mm-hmm. I think those are just really important lessons to have: is that it's not always pretty.
No, and it's not exactly what you're expecting, and that's what you said. You know, you got to get outside of your expectations, and the big thing is understanding that, you know, odor manifests itself in many ways on the track line. It's not just the track line itself, and the dogs can detect scent from amazing distances, and you can have blown odor from the human body that travels many, many yards, and if that track situation isn't visible from an olfactory standpoint, you know, let's say for example you're in the middle of a Walmart blacktop parking lot in 80 degree weather, that footstep to footstep track is going to be gone very, very quickly, and the dog has to be able to find scent in another way, which means it has to go to a productive source wherever that odor might be. So a big part of managing our expectations is allowing the dog to teach us where that scent picture might be. And in doing so, and especially when you're using the maps, like you just said, you really can get a clear representation of how that dog is actually working the environment sometimes. Another thing that we do is we do training videos for literally every single track that a student does. And we review those at the end of the day. So we review the maps. So the map, you've got the map played out. You can see exactly what the dog did on the map. But the beautiful part about the video is you can use that to identify segments in the map where various things happen. And then you can actually learn the body language of that particular situation. Where did the dog leave that track line? In other words, if that ground disturbance track line to work a different type of odor, and then what caused it, right? So in that way, we can actually help teach ourselves how to look at things a little bit differently by using the map overlays, plus also video. I think the video is really the most important part of it all. Back in the day, when I first started videotaping trails in the 90s, actually, and I had a big camera that I had on my shoulder.
Yep.
You know, believe it or not.
Yeah, I know.
And it was, so I think I have shoulder problems now because of that camera. But the reason I started doing it, and this is actually probably a really good story, is you guys have all heard of the bloodhound handlers who can follow like the 2 week old trails for the missing people, right? You've heard that stuff before.
Sure.
Right. And I can tell by your tone of voice what your feelings of it are. and pretty much the same goes for me. But, you know, when we go, if I take myself back almost 30 years, I was taught that a good bloodhound should be able to follow a 2 week to 30 day old track, no problem. And I was actually trained that way. And my first dog was actually certified for a 2 week old trail, believe it or not. And, you know, in the beginning, when I first started, I was so impressionable. And of course you do what your trainers tell you to do. You know, you want to, you know, honor their methodology as best you possibly can. And of course you're going to want to mimic it. And so a big part of what I did was I sold that program to my department. You know, I said, hey, you know, with this whole bloodhound thing, you know, we're going to be able to find kids after 2 weeks, you know, missing Alzheimer's patients. Right. Mm-hmm. And I honestly believed it. I mean, I really, truly did, because, you know, historically speaking, if you actually look, there are dogs that are finding people over those timeframes. But what I didn't realize at the time is they're finding them not necessarily by tracking or trailing, but by luck and being in the right place at the right time, or air scent, because the body's so close to the start point, you know. Mm-hmm. And but what I did was when I hit the street with my dog, you know, it was a big reality check, because I learned very, very quickly that 2 weeks was not happening. You know, it just wasn't. And then 1 week, that's not happening. And then 5 days, that's not happening. 2 days is not really happening. And what I found is my success ratios were between, you know, 20 minutes to about 6 hours. This is where the tracks were successful and we're finding people and we're finding evidence and everything else. And so, you know, I didn't quite understand at the time why, you know, and I look back at it now and it makes me wonder why it took me so long to figure it out. But I was racking my brain. How do I test this? You know, how do I find out, you know, what really works and what doesn't? And then I had this epiphany. Oh, let's just make it like a real search. I don't know who the person is. I don't know where they are. And I don't know how they got to the place that they're at. You know, in other words, a completely double blind track. And when I started, and this is when I started recording my trails, is I really wanted to see how the dog was working. And then also I wanted to watch how other handlers were working their dogs. And so the video from the third person was really good for that. And what I discovered was that, you know, trails, the scent picture dissipates very, very quickly. Ground disturbance goes fastest of all. Human odor goes a little bit later. But in most situations, you're lucky to have a good scent picture from an hour, maybe out to 10 or 12 at the most, and 10 or 12 being in pristine conditions. So that was a big hit for me, because here I sold this entire program on a dog that can follow, you know, multiple day, multiple week old trails, and come to find out that really wasn't the case. But the beauty of it is it was the foundation for everything we do today, which is double blind training, double blind certification. You know, I'm a firm believer in that methodology as much as you can possibly do it.
So do you feel that if you're watching or reviewing the video, are you able to share with handlers as you're watching together that it is at this point that the dog has left the track? Here's yeah. the change of behavior that he demonstrates that he's reacquired it. So that's a big portion of what the video is all about.
Yeah, so we spend the full day training, and then usually the next morning we go over all the trails from the previous day, and we do just that. And so we do the map overlays, you know, plus the video. And then from the tactical aspect, we do the same thing for, you know, tactical tracking for the military and police courses that we do. But not only do we have the cameras on the handler, but we'll also have them on the operators. And then we'll also put stationary cameras in the ambush locations, where when the dog team comes in, you get to see how the team or the handler's coming in from even a different perspective. So I think the more angles you can hit it from, the more information that you get, the more education you get. So I do a lot. I've got like 5 GoPros. I just got done doing one right here.
Mm-hmm. Nice. I was getting ready to ask you what cameras are you putting out and what kind of software are you using? Because, you know, being tech is great until tech gets too difficult to use.
Hey, folks, we're proud to have Hold the Line Canine Conference as a supporter and sponsor of the Working Dog Depot podcast. Joe Lukowski and staff are already securing vendors and presenters for the seminar in April. That's April 9th, 10th, and 11th in a brand new location. That's right. Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. We are especially excited about that. It's going to cut our travel time in half. and there's nothing like being in the Carolinas in early April. That's Hold the Line Canine Conference. We're very much looking forward to being there and hope to see you all there. Thank you.
I'll tell you what, the best video camera that I use right now is the GoPro Session, which unfortunately they don't make anymore. And I'll kind of show it to you. Okay. So it's very, very small. But what separates this from the normal GoPros is there's no video screen on it. And so what that means is you have a battery life that will last all day. The biggest drawback for most of the GoPros is you burn up the batteries really quick because the video screen's going at the same time. The other thing is it's literally just, it's 1 inch by 1 inch, very lightweight and very, very small. So I love this camera. Unfortunately, GoPro doesn't make it anymore. And we use it on a head mount system. So you have the straps that go over the head, and it basically gives you the handler's point of view of everything that they're doing with the dog. Now, I also use video glasses too. You know, there's a company called Zetronix, Zetronix, that they have video glasses. You know, they have shades and they have amber lenses, clear lenses, but it has a video camera right between the eyes. And that works really well too. It gives you a great perspective. And what I love about it is, unlike a body cam on a police officer, with the head mounted cam, you know, a lot of times you'll be facing forward, but you're turning your head watching your dog. And you'll always, as long as you're watching your dog, you're going to have video of it. So the GoPro, the Zetronix are what we use the most. And then from a tech standpoint, for all the video work that I do, I use Final Cut Pro on Apple products on the Macs. And then for the tracking software, where you see the map overlays, there's an app called the Man Trailing app that we use a lot.
Yes, I use that.
Yep. And I'm getting really excited about Bob Eden's new product for cats.
Yes.
His is going to be, I think his is going to take the Man Trailing app and move it into an entirely new level. I've been really monitoring and watching and seeing how that goes. I'm super, super excited. I can't wait for it to come out because, you know, that's going to give us an ability for, you know, your beat partners to actually see where the dog team is at and what they're doing, which is really going to assist quite a bit when it comes to setting up those mobile perimeters when you're on a track, you know, and that really is the reality of catching people, is getting them blocked off when you're tracking them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. you're not kidding. The teams, the places that fail to do that just don't have very good success rates.
Yeah, that's true. You got to learn how to make a perimeter or a hasty perimeter. It's super, super important. But I love the mapping software. Like you said, it gives you a whole picture. You can tell sometimes exactly what the dog did based on the terrain features and then the map line that you see. I started working with doing the map overlays probably in 2001. Mm-hmm. That's when I first started doing it. And that was with really difficult software and, you know, Garmin devices that weren't easy to download. Really, really difficult. It's so easy now. You've got a lot of different programs you can use. And the market's wide open.
So let's talk a little bit about proximity alerts. I want to say, and I think I said this on your podcast, is that I felt like I first heard that term from you. So can you just kind of walk us through what that looks like, what that is and what that looks like?
Sure. Well, first off, you need to know the history of it. I didn't invent the term. The term was actually coined by Combat Tracker Teams, which was a U.S. Army program, clandestine program during the Vietnam War. It started in the early 60s. The CTT members were U.S. Army soldiers that were paired with Labradors, and they're being trained by the British SAS in Malaysia. They had an incredibly effective program in Vietnam, finding a lot of people, a lot of bad guys, a lot of weapons caches. And my first experience with the proximity alert was working with some CTT guys. And this was in the early 90s. And the reason why it happened was I almost got killed a couple times on tracks, almost got shot, and I didn't understand really what I could do about it. You know what I mean? And you guys have been around a long time, so you know we didn't have a lot of formal training back then. It didn't exist like the guys have today. Right. And you had to wing it, or you had to come up with something on your own, but there was no internet to draw from. You know, there was, and there really wasn't any books either. So just by luck, I happened along a publication for CTT, and I met with a couple of their handlers from that time frame, and I invited them out to California. And I said, hey, I said, I'll pay you guys his way if you just come out and just watch us work, you know, see what we're doing. And, you know, let me get your 2 cents. And so we did a bunch of tracks over the course of about 3 days. And at the end of it, Frank Merritt, a good friend of mine, he said, well, you know, you got a great dog, Jeff. He goes, you just can't read the proximity alert. And I said, well, what are you talking about, the proximity alert? He goes, that's when you're getting close to the subject. And I go, I know when I'm getting close to the subject. The dog's jumping and howling and barking. And, you know, I know I'm close. He goes, no, that's when you're going to get killed. That's too close. Hmm. He goes, the proximity alert is the subtle behavior changes that occur long before that point. And so that was my first eye opening to it. And it actually brought me into a very long journey to the present day, where I've been constantly working with the proximity alert, learning about it, videotaping it over and over and over again, and learning how to read the dog's subtle body language changes that they're starting to get close. And believe it or not, they can start throwing proximity alerts hundreds and hundreds of yards away long before they get to source. And depending on the conditions, those alerts can sometimes be fairly strong. The problem is that the average handler doesn't read them. You know, they don't see them. And there's two reasons for that. Number one, training situations. And then number two, the reward system at the end. A lot of times the traditional trackers are working with a toy or a ball at the end of the track and not a human body. So there's no air scent picture. And so if you have no air scent picture, you're going to have no proximity alert. So if you're over and over and over again tracking to the end and tracking to a toy, you're building two things that are going to get you killed. One, your dog doesn't learn how to work the air scent problem at the end of the track, number one. And then number two, you've created muscle memory in yourself to always track to the end. You know what I mean? You're not reading the behavior because it's not germane to what you're doing. And so a big part of this is you have to change your paradigm in training. The first thing is that you have to add a body there. If you don't have a body, no alert. And then secondly, you have to really open your eyes to the different levels of that proximity alert. So in my book, Tactical Tracker Teams, I broke it down into basically four phases. We have the first one, which is called the far alert. And the far alert is nothing more than the dog's on the track, you've got good tracking behavior, and then suddenly that head comes up. He might wave it in the air a little bit. I call it a Stevie Wonder because that's almost what it looks like. Head comes up, he waves his head, and then he goes back to the track. The indication that it's an air scent is based on that headset and that change. And the fact that it's an alert that's kind of far away is because he has to go back to the track, which means he's not encountered the full scent pool yet. He just got a little fart of air, got a little fart of scent on the air, and then it's over. And those far alerts, depending on the wind conditions, you know, it could be 100 meters, 200 meters. I've had them as far away as 1,800 meters away on a track, on the conditions. And as the dog begins to get closer and closer, the proximity alert increases in value, and the body language changes occur as well. So the next alert is what we call the near alert. And the near alert is the dog is now beginning to get a stronger air scent picture. And instead of just a little head wave and going back to the track, they're mostly air scent and it's directional, you know, anywhere from 45 to 90 degrees. You know, they're telling you out this way, I have my subject somewhere. And depending on the wind, that could also still be pretty far. I mean, if the wind is in the face, that could be another couple hundred yards until you get to source, depending on the dog and the conditions. If the wind is at your back, on the other hand, and this is where you have to have a savvy handler that can not only read the dog, but read the environment. If the wind is at your back, that same near alert could be 10 yards away. So it's really wind dependent. And then we have what we call a triangulating alert. And this is the one where everything has to be completely shut down. Usually the near alert or the triangulating alert is when we stop forward momentum with the dog. And the triangulating alert is where if you line up the tail with the ears, you know where the subject is hiding based on the dog's behavior. And so what we teach our students to do is to recognize all these behavior changes, number one, and then how do you react accordingly with the dog and then also the tactical team in tow? You know, what is everybody's responsibilities? And, you know, the whole idea is to change the mindset of confrontation on the track. You know, I think going back to when I almost got killed, it was the confrontation mindset and always tracking to the end, you know, tracking to that body or the toy or whatever it was. I had conditioned my mind and my body to always run in to the end. not understanding that that end is what could get me killed. And so you have to change that mindset a little bit. And sometimes that can be hard, especially with, you know, classically trained police officers who've been doing this for many years, you know, mm-hmm. always doing it the same way over and over again. You really have to do some eye opening with that. So a lot of what we do with the proximity alert when we're training for it is we use, you know, I'm a firm believer in pain and embarrassment are Mother Nature's best trainers. And so we usually put our opposing force out there armed with, you know, M4s using UTM rounds or AK-47s with UTM rounds. And if you get too close and you don't call the alert, you get popped. And it's painful. I mean, mm-hmm. it's not comfortable. And if you're within 20 yards, it's going to draw blood. I mean, that's just the nature of the beast. And you do this enough, you begin to start to respect the reality of the situation. And then, really only then, that's when you start really reading the dog, because you don't want to get peppered. So we've been training this now for law enforcement. Well, my first class was in 1998, and we've been teaching it more and more and more consistently, well, since that time frame. And the cool thing about it is actually we're a DOD trainer for SOCOM, and we're the sole trainer for, you know, the SOCOM units for this particular type of trailing and tracking work in the proximity alert. And that's a big thing that they're practicing nowadays.
That's awesome.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's you brought up at the beginning that those guys were using labs in Vietnam, and I take it these weren't bite dogs. So how do you feel about that now, about tracking with animals that don't bite?
I don't think it matters, because I think the biggest problem is that it doesn't matter if you have a bite dog or a non-bite dog. If you look historically at the police officers and the canines that have been killed historically over the last 25 years, and I pay attention to them completely, almost all of them is running up on the subject at the, you know, when they shouldn't. You know, the most recent one in Florida, where the guy hops the fence and goes around the corner, you know, runs right into three bullets. You know, the whole point of our training is to take away the confrontation. Confrontation shouldn't occur, because if you have it doesn't matter if you have a bite dog or a lab, either one takes a bullet, it's going to die, you know, or the handler behind it. It doesn't really matter. And here's the big thing is that if you have a guy maliciously lying in wait and he's armed and he's in an ambush position, going into that situation is the same as going into a barricaded subject into a building. I mean, what's the difference? Think about it. I mean, maybe for you guys, probably it was. I know for me, back in the early 90s, if we had a guy barricaded in a building, we just rushed in with the dog. I mean, that's just what we did, right? But we quickly learned over time that that wasn't a safe thing to do. And now most departments don't practice that. You know, it's very rare that you see that happening. We need to have that same mindset when it comes to tracking. If you have a guy out there that's, you know, willing to die for whatever cause he's involved in, right? And he's armed, you've got to look at that as him having the advantage. And the last thing we want to do is run into a body on a track like that, because the chances of it going sideways are very high. Now, the beauty of the proximity alert, and this is what's so amazing about it, and it doesn't matter if it's a lab or a Mal or a German Shepherd, you now have a tactical advantage of the situation that you wouldn't have any other way. And let's say, for example, you're tracking along, you get that first alert from 200 yards, right? The subject has no idea you're coming at 200 yards, but you know he's out there. You have a general direction. You have an idea. You can communicate that to the command post. You can get a hasty perimeter start to be set up, or at least getting people on tap to do it, right? And your team is now prepared. So you get into a more high threat type formation that's a little bit more defensive. As you track along, that far alert turns into a near alert. Now you know you're getting very, very close, and you start to shut things down, right? The guy probably still doesn't know you're there, but yet you now have him contained because you have this information up front. Right. You know, we have to decide what's most important, I think, sometimes. And unfortunately, I think in law enforcement, especially with dog work, we have this tendency to rush in way too fast oftentimes. And with tracking and trailing, that could be a death sentence. And it has been more and more now in the last few years than ever before. And it has to stop. It really, truly does. And the only way we're going to stop it is you've got to start working on this proximity alert mentality and learning how to, you know, deal with the end of a track in a little bit different way versus a bite. Because the thing is, if that guy's armed and waiting, he can shoot the dog just as easily as he can you or anybody else. And it doesn't matter if it's a bite dog or a lab. It really doesn't.
Right. Well, I couldn't agree more. I think that's you basically make your track a surrounding call out. Now you have your location mm-hmm. tool, and now you're able to surround that person, call them out, you know, whatever things, you know, that their SOP allows them to do at that point, other than, like you said, rush in and get shot over nothing.
Exactly. You know, and the thing is most of the time the dog is not going to have the opportunity to be in a situation where it can be fully effective anyway when it's on the end of that leash, you know, towing around a 200-pound anchor behind him. You know, it's really, really rough, I think, sometimes for the dog to be an effective component if there's in any offensive or defensive capability when it's attached to the handler. And if you just watch some of our videos, I mean, I've got 2,000 on my YouTube page. And if you just go to the tactical trailing aspect of it, it doesn't matter what type of dog it is. When that ambush occurs, it's done. Mm-hmm. You can have the best bite dog on the planet, the best man eater on the planet, the most savvy tactician handler on the planet. And if you get surprised in an ambush, you're done. It's just mm-hmm. the way it's going to be. It's the way it's going to play out. And a big part of my job is to teach, you know, to just change the mentality. You know, we need to think more about different tactical solutions and less about confrontation. And it's especially in today's political world. You know, we're seeing some changes now to use of force and as it applies to patrol dogs. And frankly, it's a threat to our industry. You know, you're seeing departments, you know, coast to coast that are shutting down their programs, sometimes just to get at the head of the curve, not even because anything happened, you know. And so we've got to start thinking about things a little bit differently. We truly do.
Great. Now that's some of the best advice, if anybody's listening, that you can take for your canine mm-hmm. program, guys.
Well, I understand your philosophy, and it makes perfect sense. I do believe, though, that there are a lot, and you've experienced it. I think you've handled it with mm-hmm. tact and grace, as folks have tried to perhaps even bait you into conversation around those sorts of things. But I think it's a point of contention for a lot of handlers that firmly believe they have to have a dog that bites in order to track. I think that is a predominant mentality. But again, I think they also they're coming from a place too, where I know for a lot of my guys, they may start out with somebody that's their backup. They started out with a mm-hmm. backup mm-hmm. and they didn't end with a backup. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. it's
on their own. But that's a big part of it too. You also have to change the way we train too. And you know, a lot of times the reason why we outrun the backup is because the handlers are moving too fast, which is mm-hmm. the other reason they get killed. You know, speed kills on a track. You can't read the dog. But, you know, the problem is a lot of times our training techniques that we're using exacerbate the speed problem. And the thing is that it doesn't matter how in shape you are as a handler. If you've got your dog pulling you, you're going to be a track star. Mm-hmm. You're going to outrun everybody.
Right.
You know, I did an investigation for the Burke County Sheriff's Department and the police academy up there for a killing of a police officer on a track that they had back in, I think it was 2006 or 2016. And in that situation, you know, the backup reported seeing the handler all of a sudden moving faster than he had before, and they couldn't keep up with him anymore. They called out, tried to get him to slow down, and he wouldn't. And more than likely at the time, he was responding to the proximity alert of the subject. He went out of sight shortly thereafter, and the first shot went out, and he was killed with that first shot.
Right.
You know, so the speed is the other aspect that has to change. A lot of times we have a doctrine in tracking training where it's get on top of the dog, push, 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 and you're always moving at a trot or a light run. The problem with that is that you're going to run into a bullet, and then number two, nobody can keep up with you. You know, because mm-hmm. your dog's taking all your energy. He's doing the work for you.
Right. Do you have any suggestions as to, there's not a quick answer to this, I know, mm-hmm. and not looking for a quick one. What are suggestions that would you have to slow a dog down?
Use the environment to slow them down. You know, in other words, you get it to the point where they have no other choice, but in order to stay in odor, they have to slow down, right? And I'd like to do a lot of that off lead. Right. Because sometimes the back pressure by the handler connected to the dog is the same as back pressure on a lunge line. You know what I mean? Right. with the dog. It's the same type of situation. The back pressure, and more importantly, the proximity of the handler to the dog is creating that speed situation as well. Okay. Sometimes when you increase the gap, the distance between the dog and the handler, it creates a dog that's going to feel these less under pressures, and they have a tendency to sometimes work a little bit slower. The closer you get to the dog, sometimes the more they like to run, because frankly, they're trying to get away from you to get onto that track. And the other thing is that when you're talking about changing the environment, you can set up conditions where the scent picture is going to be so weak that they have no other choice but to detail a little bit more. And the detailing is where they start to slow down. And like I said, if you can do this off lead and not attached to the dog, it seems to work a little bit better. So again, this is one of the reasons why a lot of times with the dogs that we're starting, we start all off lead first and tracking before we actually add that leash to them.
Okay. Very good. Good stuff.
Well, in your courses, Jeff, we talked a lot about tracking tonight, and this is some of the best information we've had on tracking since we've been doing this, and I really appreciate it. What else does your schools offer up there? What else do you teach?
Well, it's scent work. You know, most of my clients are bite dogs, but we don't teach bite work here. We do simply tracking and detection work. That's really it. Nothing else. So, but tracking is probably most of it. I mean, we have some people that come for the detection courses, but I think we're so busy with tracking, we don't really have time for much of anything else. I literally have a school every day of the week, you know, I'm training dogs every week of the year, 365 days a year. And if it's not me, it's usually one of my trainers. We have probably 1,000 dogs that go through the program a year, more than likely.
That's pretty impressive. That's a lot of dogs, a lot of dog poop too.
Well, it's not just here. It's also in Europe. We have a big footprint in Europe with the police departments out there. So we have a lot of dogs out there as well.
Very cool.
So you are speaking at HITS, correct?
I am. Yeah. I'm doing a special class, actually. It's a little bit related to the proximity alert, but it's going to be scent pools, human scent pools, and IED scent pools, and how the dogs deal with them in tracks. You know, we actually encountered a certain anomaly years ago when I first started working with some of the military teams, where we have these dogs that are incredibly great detection dogs. I mean, they've been in combat and doing this for real on a regular basis. And then we add the tracking component to what they're doing. And what we discovered is that they would sometimes not even react at all to an IED in the middle of a track. They just, or what we thought was almost no reaction. But what was happening is they're detecting the IED from a distance, and then they're circumnavigating it. Right, they're circling around it and then picking up the track on the outside. Every now and then they go through the middle of it, depending on the wind conditions. But a big part of these human scent pools, and whether it's a live pool with a body in it or a dead pool, an IED, the dogs have a tendency sometimes to not do what you expect them to do in that situation. They don't go in and they don't ID. They have a tendency to go around the device. And that's because of the scent picture that's been created there from the scent pool of human activity, you know, the building of the device, everything that went into that process created a massive scent pool. And what dogs have a tendency to do with scent pools is not to get into the middle of it on a track, because if they get into the middle of it, it slows down the tracking process. So what they have a tendency to do is to go around it. They detect the scent pool from a distance and then they circle around it. So we're going to be talking a lot about that, you know, in that particular anomaly, because I don't think it's ever really been discussed before in professional tracking work. And then also how ambushes play out with the air scent as well.
Okay. Nice. Very good. So is this a new class?
Interesting. I'd like to be there for that one. That'd be good information.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. I'll sit in for you. How's that?
Well, I appreciate it, but you'll keep it all to
yourself.
There
you go.
That's what you normally do, Howard. He keeps it all to himself.
Well, Jeff, we want to be respectful of your time. And also, will you let folks know how to get a hold of you?
Yeah, sure. Well, the easiest way is at my website. That's gak9.com. G as in George, A as in Adam, K as in King, the number 9.com. You just Google that or Georgia Canine and we'll pop up, or my name. Love to talk to anybody out there that's interested in what we do. And thanks a lot for having me on, guys. I really appreciate it. It was nice to do this.
Yeah, well, that was our pleasure. I enjoyed meeting you.
Very good. Y'all have a good evening.
Well, Howard, that was a great episode, man. I almost want to have him back on right now because I have so many more questions. He was going, you know, he was just going and going and going. And I didn't want to interrupt him because he was putting out some great information. I have better questions to ask now than I did during the show.
Well, you know what? I think we could do a second episode with him. He is that kind of guy. He certainly is a wealth of information and has trained lots and lots of people, lots of dogs and teams, and very much in demand. And such a nice guy.
Nice. Well, and I liked how he's niched his company down into that detection mode. You know, tracking is their thing, and that's awesome. And it's obvious because he's good at it. You can tell.
Right.
Good information. Well, so what is on the agenda tonight?
Tonight we're doing the infamous Blantons.
Ah, Blantons.
Blantons is like the pinnacle for a lot of people. It is the pinnacle.
It's a tasty bourbon now, for sure.
It is. And it's very hard to come by because it is in such high demand. It's that Buffalo Trace distillery again.
Yeah, well, you know, they did sell their soul to the devil. They don't put anything out this bad.
Nope.
Oh, that smells good. It's good.
It's good.
Well, my friend, as always, here's to the hair of the dog that bit you.
Have a good evening, bud.
Thanks so much, you guys, for following along, supporting us, and listening to these wonderful conversations that Howard and I are just blessed to have each and every day. We'd like to thank and support all of our first responders, police, fire, EMS, and our military for once again holding the line, keeping us safe. Stay safe, brothers and sisters. We love you. God bless, and God bless America.